Conference number 16, 4 p.m., September 26, 1985. Father Hugo.
We'll have confessions tomorrow for those who desire to receive the sacrament of penance. We're not pressing you to do that, but we're offering you the opportunity. It's a good way to indicate, to seal a new effort of metanoia, of changing, of turning about. But we'll announce that tomorrow. I just gave you that. That's an examination of conscience. I wouldn't call it official, but it's a quasi-official. It came out with the new rite of penance. And I think you'll find it an improvement over some of the ones that you've seen in the past. It's not hunting for mortal sins. Not just a laundry list. It's suggestions of possible failures and of devout people, of people who are really oriented towards holiness but still experience failures. And so you can look at it and see if it's useful to you. I would say there are two poles in the confession of a devout person. The first one, and the higher one, would be perfection, the goal of perfection, the perfection of love, the perfection of Christian holiness. We should keep in sight that goal, and we measure our failures against that goal rather than against the reason or just by sin. We wish to live the ethics of love, the rule of love, rather than the rule of law. So we should always keep our focus on that goal of perfect love that we're moving towards day by day, hopefully. And then the lower limit, the other pole, the south pole, would be what we spoke of yesterday, the capital sins, those dispositions. They're not sins. They're called capital sins because the word here is capit, head, because they're the source of sins. But they're themselves not sins. They're dispositions. They're an orientation, a turning of the mind and heart. And if they're allowed to grow, then they become sins. But as they are, they're simply a seed ground for sin, I guess you might call them. And they show the areas of our probable failures. There's only seven of them, so an examination of conscience shouldn't take so long, but they are sources of sin. And then in between it, you might find some of these things that we are indicated in this particular examen of conscience, or failures that you see in living the Beatitudes there. It's always necessary, in order to receive absolution, to confess at least one definite sin. That could be from your past. Doesn't have to be a serious sin, but if there's any particular sin that you're especially sorry for and grieve over, and we don't want you to be recalling past confessions, but you can repeat that, renew that, and get absolution. Many of these things are what would be called imperfections. They're really not sins. They're not moral offenses at all, but they're failures. Lack of love, I guess that's the best way to speak of an imperfection. It's a failure of love. It doesn't have any moral content. It has no more evil in it. But it's a lack of love. I eat too much, let us say. Maybe just a little bit too much. Or drink too much. Just a little bit too much. They're not grievous sin, but you feel that you're not just doing everything that you should in that area to discipline the desires. So that would be an example of imperfection. Any action which does not have the full quota of love that it might have, even though it's a good action in itself, like almsgiving. We saw how even almsgiving or prayer can be definitely an imperfection, a failure of love, or fasting even. Well, there's some confessors don't be interested in that. They'll throw you out of the confessionals. So you have to choose your confessor well in that. Don't go out committing mortal sins in order to get a good hearing. You know, some people are disappointed because they don't have an original mortal sin to confess every week or every month, at any rate. But I don't think you should try too hard in that direction. Now, let's say a prayer. I was looking for it here, and Father, by the love of your Spirit, may we who have experienced the grace of the Lord's resurrection rise to the newness of life in joy. This we ask through Christ the Lord. Now we're going to open a new theme this time, but I'm not going to do it right away. I'm going to finish the theme we just almost finished. That would be number 8, the conflict, light and darkness. There's a few more points I would like to make, and then we'll start on our next theme, and really we'll start then with the conclusion of our retreat, the Paschal Mystery. This is preparation for the Paschal Mystery, this understanding. So we've come down now to the nature of the... We've been studying probably the oldest, the almost insoluble problem of the relationship of nature and grace, to discover how the activity of nature is geared into grace, how they're joined together into a unity of action. It's a very difficult and subtle subject, and it's mysterious, as the human heart is mysterious, and grace is even more mysterious, so we can't have perfect clarity about it. We can go as far as we can, faith-seeking understanding. And so I think that the outline that I have given you is the best I know of, the best I've ever seen, the double relationship of nature and grace, the harmony, the threefold harmony between nature and grace, and then the very definite conflict in nature and grace, a conflict that exists without implying any evil in nature. The evil is in our hearts, or the conflict is in our hearts, our desires. Desire, then, is the source. We said it's like the wind, like a breeze that becomes a cyclone. Another good example of the possibility of desires is a piano keyboard. You know those 8 notes? I think they're 8, do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do. You know, they have infinite possibilities. A musician can make beautiful music out of them. And a non-musician can make horrible noise out of them. And sometimes certain musicians can make horrible noise out of them. Some modern music, you see, that is based on cacophony. That is the absence of rhythm and harmony. So we can make them cacophonous, or we can make them rhythmic and melodious. In the same way, with our desires, we can use them to create harmony with God, harmony between nature and grace. That's a blank area there. What God made is in harmony already, nature and grace. But there's that zone in there of our freedom, and we have to bring that in harmony with nature, with grace. And if we do, then we are growing in grace, growing in holiness. Or we can bring them into conflict. We can create the cacophony, the noise. And that's sin. They're the same basic notes. you have the same, the just man or woman and the evil man or woman have the same basic desires. But they're using them differently, like you're playing a noisy piece of music with one, with the, those basic notes, and then you're playing a beautiful melody by a master with those basic notes. So this is what we can do, and it's in our freedom where the turning takes place towards God and towards man. This brings me to what a principle of spirituality and theology, which we might call, which I call, I don't know whether anybody else calls it, but it's not, I'm not the only one that knows it. It comes from St. Thomas. I'm the only one that claims to know it, but I give it the name, the pivot of the spiritual life, or the pivot of St. Thomas. And it's very simple. St. Thomas was a wise person, as I mentioned before, but he was very simple. He says, we are placed midway between the good things of this world and the treasures of heaven in such wise that the more we can become attached to one set of goods, the more we become detached from the other set of goods. In other words, as the love of creatures grows in us, then the love of God will diminish. The love of God diminishes us, and the love of creatures diminishes. We have only one heart, and it's like a vessel. You can't fill it with both with water and wine. You'll dilute the wine if you pour the water in. And so in our hearts, we stand between these, and we grow in love, and then we lose that love of the world. We still may live in the world and use the world, but we lose that love of the world, that absorption in the world and in its values. On the other hand, as we grow in the love of the world, then we lose our love of God. And of course, then if the love of creatures reaches a certain point, we turn completely away from God. Like an adulterer turns completely away from his wife, or then it becomes mortal sin. That's what we mean by mortal sin, when we turn completely away from God and take a creature as our idol. That's mortal sin. On the way to mortal sin, we can commit venial sins. And if we can compare a mortal sin to adultery, as the scriptures do, we can compare venial sin to a flirtation. What a person might call a minor flirtation, you see. Oh, that's only a venial sin. That's a minor flirtation. But if a husband would tell his wife, or a wife would tell her husband, it's only a minor flirtation, their partner may not agree. Love does not desire any affront at all. And they would certainly discourage and hate a minor flirtation. And the husband would not wish it to be known to his wife, nor would the wife wish it to be known to her husband. And so I think we ought to use that phrase, only a venial sin, less often. We should regard all sin as an affront to God, not just as a breaking of a rule, but as an affront to God, a personal affront to God. That's the way the Hebrews taught us to do it. I think it's the best way to think of sin. I think sometimes our catechism definitions are defective because they make it look like a thing, impersonal, mechanical, instead of that, what it is, an affront to the person of God, an affront to the love of God. So consider venial sin. St. Teresa said she would die rather than break a rubric. Now, maybe that's an exaggeration, but I think it was true. She would. She would not consciously do anything to displease God. I think many of the saints were that way. You might call that scrupulosity. I would call it sensitivity. Sensitivity. Just as a man or a woman who is sensitive to the feelings of their wife or husband would not engage even in what they might consider a minor flirtation. Love is very sensitive about these things. So that's the pivot of St. Thomas. We can turn one way or the other. Now, I use the example of the man. I should use the example of the woman. The woman, the bride, stands for us. I don't like to be sexist, though, and if I talk too much about the sins of the woman, I'll be considered sexist. So I take the man as an example. But properly, scripturally speaking, we should take the woman as an example. That was the way Hosea saw it. The wife stands for God's people. And if we turn away from God, then we are guilty of the flirtation. The wife is guilty in this image of the flirtation. Or if she turns completely away, then she's guilty of the adultery. And as I mentioned, that's why the prophets call the Hebrew people fornicators and adulterers. Because they turn away from God. They had a very good perception of this relationship as one of love. And that brings us, you see, to the understanding of what sin is. That's really what it is. The catechism says a grievous offense against God. Well, that's true, but that's a somewhat abstract definition. To say spiritual adultery is really vivid and shows you the nature of the thing, really. And to say that venial sin is flirtation reveals that. So, now one other point we should mention on your outline there. It speaks of the genesis of personal sin. We talked about the desires as the potential source of sin. They are the tinder from which sin would come. They are the notes from which the cacophonous melody is made. You see, they are the breeze that may turn into a cyclone. But by themselves, even the capital sins are without moral guilt. They are a disposition, a push in that direction. But they're not yet a sin. A sin has to be free and deliberate before it's truly a sin. Now, in St. James, we have a nice little passage there which gives us what we might call the genesis of sin, and in the scriptural fashion, he gives it to us in an image, a very concrete image. The birth of a monster. We saw how the baptism is the birth of a child, or compared to the birth of a child. But this we have now, we witness in sin, we witness the birth of a monster. The conception and the deliverance of a monster. Delivery. James chapter 1, verse 12. Happy the man who holds out to the end through trial. Notice the word trial. Once he has been proved, he will receive the crown of life. I would add, underscore by saying, once his love has been proved, that's it. Once his love has been proved and refined, which the Lord has promised to those who love him. Well, St. James says it all there. He has promised the reward to those who love him. No one who is tempted, now there's a shift in the word. No one who is tempted is free to say, I am being tempted by God. Here we have that word temptation used in two different meanings, two different senses. One is a trial and one is a seduction. We've just been told that life is a trial, but now he says, but no one is seduced by God. I am being tempted by God. Surely God, who is beyond the grasp of evil, tempts no one. So God will not draw us to evil, but he does try us, or he puts us in a situation in which trial is inevitable and even desirable, both from his point of view and from our point of view, because it's the only way that love can be tested and can grow, by this love of preference, especially. Now, then he gives the answer as he puts it. Rather, the tug and the lure have his own passion tempt every man. The desire, we're back here to the lure, the desire, that's a synonym for desire. And in some of your translation, the word desire is used. They've changed it here. Yes. Our passion and desire, that's the tug, the passion and the desire, they lure us. So our desires lead us into sin. And then here comes that image. Once passion, now here he goes back to the word passion. Once passion, or a passionate desire, passion is desire, a very strong desire like lust. Once passion has conceived, now there comes the monster, the conception of a monster. It gives birth to sin. And when sin reaches maturity, it begets death. The three phases of conception, birth, and begetting, it begets death. It can grow up only negatively to beget death. This is how sin occurs. So, you see, St. James confirms and illustrates what we saw this afternoon in St. Paul and in Jesus himself, that sin begins in desire. This is how sin comes. And that's why it's our responsibility. That's the area we can control. That's the area in which our freedom is definitely there. So this shows a sin. And when we commit a sin, that's mortal sin. It begets death, so that's mortal sin. Now, one further remark on sin that I think we should make here, and to complete this subject for now, is that what we call penance or satisfaction in a narrow sense is an attempt to reverse. Suppose one has committed a sin. Now, we wish to not only, we want to be penitent for it. Penance is a hatred for sin and a rejection of sin, coupled with a desire to reverse the sin, and we reverse the sin by satisfaction, or what we call outward penance. That's why I say one would fast or give an offering to the poor. This is to give up some of the treasures of this world, the good things of this world. You fast from liquor, fast from food, fast from any good thing, you see. Over interest in clothing or style, we can fast from this and punish ourselves, do penance. And so this is why penance then requires some kind of an outward mark or manifestation or expression. Because we are human beings, we are body and as well as soul, and although the sin is in our conscience, it has been accomplished usually through our bodies. And therefore, we, as it were, punish the bodies. Here's where mortification becomes a punishment. The kind of mortification we've been talking about mostly so far is an act of preference, a choosing of God over material things, the choosing by a lover of the beloved over rivals. But now, so there is this mortification of preference, the mortification of love. But now, we're talking here about a mortification which is definitely aimed at sin. We've sinned by stealing, let us suppose, and we wish to do penance, so we renounce money, which is so precious to us. Or if a sin of sensuality, we renounce some sensual satisfaction, which is so precious to us, which has been so precious to us that has lured us away from God. So this is penance in the sense of atonement or satisfaction, an outward satisfaction. Now, in confession, the priest is told that he should impose a penance or a satisfaction on people for sin. Usually that satisfaction is very unsatisfactorily liked. Even the penitent sometimes is not satisfied with it because they become sort of routine. Partly that's inevitable because this confessor doesn't know you. He doesn't know your situation in life that well unless he's your usual confessor and you confess face to face. He may not know your condition of health. He doesn't want to impose fasting. He doesn't want to impose any financial hardships on you. These are things that you have to decide yourself. So, therefore, the penance sometimes becomes a matter of routine. The priest may try to find a penance for you that's satisfactory, but it's very difficult. The only one really that can find it is yourself. I often ask penitents to, well, you suggest what your penance should be. And then I can comment on that. Tell me something that you would consider a penance in this regard. And so we can tailor it that way. But there should be some outward thing, and this is why we should do the works of penance. But it should be done freely and voluntarily. The church changed the law of fasting for us. And of course the idea was that people would be able to do this themselves, but I don't know whether we do or not, whether we fast any more or even as much as we did. It's something we can readily forget. So we have to find this ourselves to do penance. There is a revival of interest in penance, especially today. We find people are conscious of the fact that fasting is not done just to lose weight or to be beautiful, but fasting is done to release money for the poor. That fasting can be an act of love. Sometimes fasting has been criticized because it's so negative. It's just giving something up. But we give something up in order to have more to give. We give it to God's image if we can't give it directly to God. And sometimes you can give it directly to God by giving it to some charitable cause that's in need. Like today, let us say these people that are suffering in Mexico and those that are suffering over in Ethiopia. People that are starving. These are good works of penance. And perhaps we might, in our sorrow for our sins, make offerings that hurt somewhat, that are truly penitential. You know? I heard somebody, they were lighting votive candles on a stand, and one man said there, well, you shouldn't be doing that. He says, that costs nickels. You have to do a penance that costs nickels or dimes to do that. He says, oh, I got lots of dimes. There's no penance there, really, you know. But the penance is something that bites, has a little bit of a bite in it. And that does mean a renunciation of something you might want or desire, or even something you might need, would be a penance. Now, we need to do penance. Not only because it's the proper thing to do, because it's the only way we can learn the cost of sin. Sin has a terrible cost. Every time you look at the crucifix, you're looking at the cost of sin. And we take it routinely, and we walk out of the confessional of our sins, you know, and we forget about them and don't willing to do even the slight penance that the priest gives us there. We are not willing to share the cost. We don't know what it costs. People who don't know the cost of things are irresponsible. They throw money. We talk politicians, workers for public works, workers for institutions. They don't know the cost of things, and so they waste things. We hear all kinds of wasteful expenditures in the Pentagon. What do they care? They don't know the cost. They don't face the cost. When the Indians came here to this country and the white man in his great generosity offered them a bottle of whiskey or a bag of beads for 10 million acres of land, the Indians took it because they didn't know the value of the land. They thought they were getting something. We gave them a few baubles. They had paid nothing for it. And they didn't know its value, and so they gave it away. Now we read in the paper every day that they regret this awful generosity which lost them their own country, their own livelihood. And we were glad. We took advantage of them, their ignorance and their lack of civilization to do this to them. But the point here is, you see, they didn't know the value because they didn't know the cost. And we don't know, we wonder why we don't love Jesus more. Well, we don't know the value of what he did for us because we have not shared the cost. Or again, a prospector, you know, He comes over here, and he, or they did, I don't suppose they do it that way anymore, he looks for gold, gold nuggets in the water and in the land. And the Indians, again, would throw it away. They'd hand him a nugget. It was just a rock to them. They didn't know the value of that gold in there, but the prospector knew it. He had sacrificed, left his home to come here from across the Atlantic in the hope of becoming rich. He knew it. He knew the cost of the nugget. The Indians threw the gold away again like they threw away the land because they didn't know the cost. So it's a good thing to know the cost of things. And even in generally we speak of people, we say they're not responsible. They just don't know what it costs to live. So they just use things wastefully. Well, now this is true religiously. So in order to learn the cost, we must carry out that type of mortification which is called penitential, atonement, expiation. And as St. Paul puts it, we fill up those things which are lacking in the sufferings of Christ. What is lacking in the sufferings of Christ? Your sufferings and mine. The whole mystical body should suffer with Christ. That's what it means. It's referring to the mystical body of Christ, filling up those things which are lacking. All the sufferings and trials and mortifications of those who belong to the mystical body can be added to those of Christ for the redemption of the world. And so we add to the redemptive value of the world, of Christ himself, by adding our sufferings. And we share the cost of the redemption by doing it. If we insist on living just an easy, carefree, Epicurean life, then we are utterly irresponsible. We may go to Mass, we may carry out other duties or devotions, but we are not sharing the cost. So we complete our confession, therefore, our act of inward penance and contrition by helping to pay for the cross. This would impose on us obligations that hurt. Sharing our benefits, sharing our wealth, sharing our money to a degree that hurts. Now, that completes what we have to say on this subject, the conflict between nature and grace, and this abyss of sin now between what we call incarnational spirituality and paschal spirituality is an abyss. And it was this sin that made it necessary for us to have a suffering Savior. As I said, there is a very strong view and a theology in the Church, led by the Franciscans, especially the Franciscan teachers, and the Duns Scotus, that even though there had been no sin, even apart from God's prevision of sin, God had from the foundation of the world decided on creation, at the center of which and at the apex of which would be the man Christ Jesus, and that the universe would serve him and be under him, and he would bring it all together to offer to the Father. That's a beautiful, that's called the doctrine of the absolute primacy of Christ. Now, it is not a teaching of the Church, but it is a teaching of many churchmen and many scholars and many saints, like a St. Francis de Sales. And it gives us, I think, the most magnificent view of Christ of all. I'm definitely, in this respect, a Franciscan. And it's opposed or was not appreciated by St. Thomas, and that's what causes the difficulty in the Church. St. Thomas couldn't quite see this. And so he withheld his assent. But Duns Scotus taught it, and he has the approval of the church. It lets us see, I think, the whole plan of God in all its magnificence and beauty and its universality. Apart from sin, even apart from God's prevision of sin, Jesus Christ would have been the Savior, the incarnate God, for our sanctification. But we wouldn't need, in that case, if there were no sin, we wouldn't need expiation, so he would come only to sanctify us, but he would come. It would be he. He would still be the one foundation of it all. Think about that. Now, we go over to the next, the Paschal mystery. We reckon that sin has occurred and it does need expiation, and because it needs expiation, the Son of God will offer his flawless humanity to the enemies of God, and he will suffer and die for us. This is where it comes into the picture. And so now we cross that abyss, the abyss of sin, to participate in the Paschal mystery. The Paschal mystery, as we know it now, centered in the life and death of Christ, would not have occurred without the sin of the human race. And it's intended to cancel out that sin, but it's always intended, in the first place, to restore us to the original plan of God, which is to make us saints and to live in communion with Him. That's the original plan of God, and Christ restores that. Like a father who sends his children on an errand, and they have an accident, and he sends out the means to send somebody, sends out the elder brother of the family to take care of those children who have been hurt in the accident. Now, the Paschal mystery and the folly of the cross. The Paschal mystery is a phrase that those of you who are over 21 didn't hear much of before the Vatican Council. It's a phrase that has been come into general use since the Vatican Council. But it did not originate with the Vatican Council. But there has been a new awareness of its meaning in our theology, in our teaching, and in our lives since the Second Vatican Council. It is one of the great things that the Second Vatican Council did, was to pronounce the Paschal mystery as the very center of the Christian life. And the center of our liturgy. It is often stated that the Vatican Council did not give us any new definitions of doctrine, and that, I guess, is true. But it's given us a new awareness, like that little pamphlet I gave you the other day, the spearhead of renewal. It has given us a new awareness of what has, in truth, always been the teaching of the Church, but never enforced, the people were never sufficiently aware of it, namely, the doctrine that all baptized Christians have as their first vocation, before any other vocation, to the religious life, or to parenthood, or to the priesthood, or to anything, their first vocation is to be holy, to be holy as God is holy. That's the basic vocation of all Christians. That's now clear. It should be clear. Undeniable. Unquestionable. I don't have to quote an individual pope like Pius XI or an individual doctor like Thomas Aquinas. Now it's been said by a general council. As I said, it's about one of the two best kept secrets of this council, but it's there. And now here's another one. The Paschal mystery. You hear the phrase a good bit, but very few people understand what it means. Because we live on the surface of religion, and we don't... It's a kind of an in-word to talk about the Paschal mystery. You are in the club if you can use that phrase. But many of the people who use it don't understand its meaning. Now, what's what we want to do? It is I have on that sheet there, out there, the Vatican Council has told us two things about the Paschal Mystery. Told us that it is the center of the Christian life, and it's the center of the Christian liturgy. It's the explanation of the Christian liturgy. Our liturgy is a perpetual renewal of the Paschal Mystery of the Lord's death and resurrection. That's what the Mass is. That's what the sacraments grouped around the Mass are. A continual renewal of the Paschal Mystery in our presence, in our lives, in the place where we live. With the opportunity for us to join in that Paschal Mystery. Not just as a spectacle, but as an opportunity for us to join it and to live it. And so I can tell you that the Paschal Mystery consists essentially in the life and the death and the resurrection of Jesus. But sometimes we think of that death and resurrection of Jesus as something remote from us. It wasn't nice for him to come and die for us, but the Paschal Mystery is such that it involves us in that death in order to involve us also in that resurrection. The Paschal Mystery is our mystery as well as Christ's mystery. And here in this retreat, we're more interested. I'm not going to spend any time trying to make a vivid description of the Passion of Christ. We've done that presumably in Lent. We're going to take that for granted and see our part in the Paschal Mystery. How we share it. And how this is the very center of our worship. Now, for the first time, we have some satisfactory understanding of what the Mass is. When I was even in a seminary and a young priest, there was all kinds of theory about the Mass, how it was a sacrifice. But there was no certain teaching about it. Since the Vatican Council, I think there must have been tons of those theological books just thrown away as useless. Well, they were useful in the sense that they created an atmosphere of discussion among theologians and teachers, which eventually resulted in this teaching of the Paschal Mystery. But, I mean, they're useless in the sense that we wouldn't study them anymore. So all our study of the sacraments now centers around the Paschal Mystery of the Lord's death and resurrection. The Eucharist makes it present, and the other sacraments manifest its power. And that's the way we think of the real presence now in the church. Some people think in the Catholic Church we don't no longer believe in the real presence. We certainly do. But we just don't believe that Christ is present in the sense of standing there waiting for our adoration. He is present in the sense that he is renewing his death and resurrection and inviting us to join it. Don't just stand there, we say to somebody, do something. And so in the old days, we would adore Christ before the Blessed Sacrament. Now we're invited to share in the culminating mystery of his life, the Passover mystery of his death and his resurrection. And so I have the two quotations up there. They're the authority for these statements that I'm making. The Paschal Mystery as the center of the Christian life is defined in these words. The interesting thing that this definition was made, this teaching was given, in probably the least read document of the Second Vatican Council, the Constitution on the Liturgy. I used to teach the liturgy. I was on the liturgical commission. And I remember one time whenever I was teaching a course down at Central Catholic High School on the liturgy, and people were there in the evening signing up for the course, and I heard a woman in the back of me, she said, I'm going to sign up for that course in the liturgy. I want to take that. I was delighted, of course. And then her pastor chimed in. He said, don't bother with that. He says, there's nothing in there. He says, all you have to do is know the rules. We have the missalettes. Don't bother with that course. That deflated me. But I think that's what many people think, and that's what many priests think. They never read the document on the Constitution on the liturgy. And so they've never even discovered that the Vatican Council has done anything about it. But it's very central. I'm sure future generations will know all about it, or something about it. So it says, the liturgy through which the work of our redemption is accomplished is the outstanding means whereby the faithful may express in their lives and manifest to others the mystery of Christ. That's what the liturgy is. It's not just a set of a rule book for a kind of a dance up there in the front of the church, a ritualistic dance. Express and manifest to others the mystery of Christ and the real nature of the true church. The real nature of the true church is to keep alive and present always, forever, and everywhere the paschal mystery of the Lord's death and resurrection. Then the other statement is this. The wonderful works of God in the Old Testament were but a present.